About the author. I'm here to talk to you about ideas. But I think a purpose might be served in telling a little bit about myself, so I become a person like you, rather than just another talking head from the television set. I know that sometimes when I hear a news report from TV, I wonder, who are you? And why are you telling me these things? So let me offer you some of the ground out of which these ideas grew. I've worked as a New York City school teacher for the past 30 years, teaching for some of that time elite children from Manhattan's Upper West Side, between Lincoln Center, where the opera is, and Columbia University, where the defense contracts are. And teaching, in most recent years, children from Harlem and Spanish Harlem, whose lives are shaped by the dangerous undercurrents of the industrial city in decay. I've taught at 6 different schools in that time. My present school is in the shadow of St. John the Divine Cathedral, the largest Gothic structure in the United States, and not a long walk from the famous Museum of Natural History and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. About 3 blocks from my school is the spot where the Central Park jogger, as media mythology refers to her, was raped and brutally beaten a few years ago. 7 of the 9 attackers went to schools in my district. My own perspective on things, however, was shaped a long way from New York City, in the river town of Monongahela, Pennsylvania, 40 miles southeast of Pittsburgh. In those days, Monongahela was a place of steel mills and coal mines, of paddle-wheel river steamers churning the emerald green water chemical orange, of respect for hard work and family life. Monongahela was a place with muted class distinctions, since everyone was more or less poor, although very few, I suspect, knew they were poor. It was a place where independence, toughness, and self-reliance were honored, a place where pride in ethnic and local culture was very intense. It was an altogether wonderful place to grow up, even to grow up poor. People talked to each other, minding each other's business instead of the abstract business of the world. Indeed, the larger world hardly extended beyond Pittsburgh, a wonderful dark steel city worth a trip to see once or twice a year. Nobody in my memory felt confined by Monongahela or dwelled within my earshot on the possibility they were missing something important by not being elsewhere. My grandfather was the town printer and had been for a time the publisher of the town newspaper, the Daily Republican, a name that attracted some attention because the town was a stronghold of the Democratic Party. From my grandfather and his independent German ways, I learned a great deal that I might have missed if I had grown up in a time, like today, when old people are put away in a home or kept out of sight. Living in Manhattan has been for me in many ways like living on the moon. Even though I've been here for 35 years, my heart and habit are still in Monongahela. Nevertheless, the shock of Manhattan's very different society and values sharpened my sense of difference and made me an anthropologist as well as a schoolteacher. Over the past 30 years, I've used my classes as a laboratory where I could learn a broader range of what human possibility is, the whole catalog of hopes and fears, and also as a place where I could study what releases and what inhibits human power. During that time, I've come to believe that genius is an exceedingly common human quality, probably natural to most of us. I didn't want to accept that notion. Far from it. My own training in 2 elite universities taught me that intelligence and talent distributed themselves economically over a bell curve, and that human destiny, because of those mathematical, seemingly irrefutable scientific facts, was as rigorously determined as John Calvin contended. The trouble was that the unlikeliest kids kept demonstrating to me at random moments so many of the hallmarks of human excellence: insight, wisdom, justice, resourcefulness, courage, originality, that I became confused. They didn't do this often enough to make my teaching easy, but they did it often enough that I began to wonder, reluctantly, whether it was possible that being in school itself was what was dumbing them down. Was it possible I had been hired not to enlarge children's power but to diminish it? That seemed crazy on the face of it, but slowly I began to realize that the bells and the confinement, the crazy sequences, the age segregation, the lack of privacy, the constant surveillance, and all the rest of the national curriculum of schooling were designed exactly as if someone had set out to prevent children from learning how to think and act, to coax them into addiction and dependent behavior. Bit by bit, I began to devise guerrilla exercises to allow as many of the kids I taught as possible the raw material people have always used to educate themselves. Privacy, choice, freedom from surveillance, and as broad a range of situations and human associations as my limited power and resources could manage. In simpler terms, I tried to maneuver them into positions where they would have a chance to be their own teachers and to make themselves the major text of their own education. In theoretical, metaphorical terms, the idea I began to explore was this one: that teaching is nothing like the art of painting, where by the addition of material to a surface, an image is synthetically produced, but more like the art of sculpture, where by the subtraction of material, an image already locked in the stone is enabled to emerge. It is a crucial distinction. In other words, I dropped the idea that I was an expert whose job it was to fill the little heads with my expertise, and began to explore how I could remove those obstacles that prevented the inherent genius of children from gathering itself. I no longer felt comfortable defining my work as bestowing wisdom on a struggling classroom audience, although I continue to this day in those futile essays because of the nature of institutional teaching. Wherever possible, I've broken with teaching tradition and sent kids down their separate paths to their own private truths. The sociology of government monopoly schools has evolved in such a way that a premise like mine jeopardizes the total institution if it spreads. Kept contained, the occasional teacher who makes a discovery like mine is at worst an annoyance to the chain of command, which has evolved automatic defenses to isolate such bacilli and then to neutralize or destroy them. But once loose, the idea could imperil the central assumptions which allow the institutional school to sustain itself, such as the false assumption that it is difficult to learn to read, or that kids resist learning, and many more. Indeed, the very stability of our economy is threatened by any form of education that might change the nature of human product schools now turn out. The economy school children currently expect to live under and serve would not survive a generation of young people trained, for example, to think critically. Success in my practice involves a large component of automatic trust, categorical trust, not the kind conditional on performance. People have to be allowed to make their own mistakes and to try again, or they will never master themselves, although they may well seem to be competent when they have in fact only memorized or imitated someone else's performance. Success in my practice also involves challenging many comfortable assumptions about what is worth learning and out of what material a good life is fashioned. Over the years of wrestling with the obstacles that stand between child and education, I've come to believe that government monopoly schools are structurally unreformable. They cannot function if their central myths are exposed and abandoned. Over the years, I've come to see that whatever I thought I was doing as a teacher, most of what I actually was doing was teaching an invisible curriculum that reinforced the myths of the school institution and those of an economy based on caste. When I was trying to decide what to say to you that might make my experience as a school teacher useful, it occurred to me that I could best serve by telling you what I do that is wrong, rather than what I do that is right. What I do that is right is simple to understand. I get out of kids' way. I give them space and time and respect. What I do that is wrong, however, is strange, complex, and frightening. Let me begin to show you what that is.